Hello and welcome back to another episode of Millennialism. My name is Adam Gavin and I am the host of this show. Every week I sit down to chat and interview a guest about a topic that interests me. I've had entrepreneurs, award-winning authors, esteemed academics, pioneering filmmakers, TED speakers, philosophers, and friends come on the show to discuss everything from social media to health, business to culture, self-development to global travel. Millennialism is the podcast for anyone who wants to learn a little bit more about the world. My goal is always to have great conversations sprinkled with some actionable insights on how to get the most out of your life. I post new episodes every Friday, so make sure to subscribe so you never miss one. This week, I am very honored to be joined by Brian Penny, a PhD candidate in neuroscience and lecturer at Trinity College and University College Dublin. In his new memoir, Bonus Time, Brian writes about his journey through a 15-year heroin addiction onto a post-recovery career as a speaker, neuroscience lecturer, and PhD student. In this episode, Brian shares his story of overcoming addiction, how anyone can implement the lessons he learned, and the importance of affirming your own values, asking yourself the right questions, and visualizing the things you want to achieve. Brian believes he was given a second chance in life, and he does not intend to waste any of it, which makes me really appreciate him wanting to come on this show even more. He's an expert on the nature of human suffering and has given more thought to the meaning of life than anyone I've ever talked to, I think. Please don't forget to share, subscribe, like, and all that stuff, and buy Bonus Time. I really look forward to reading this book, but for now, enjoy this conversation with Brian Penny. All right. First of all, I just want to welcome you to the show. It's great to have you here, Brian. Good to see you.
Delighted to be here, Adam.
Yeah. How are you?
I'm really good, all things considering. I have to say, it's funny. There's a line that I've been saying to a couple of people in the last few days. For context, we're in the middle of COVID. I think Ireland, where I am, will be locking down soon. And I don't say this in a boastful way or anything like that, but it's really the tools that I've been practicing in my own life. Like, I feel like I'm thriving in this environment. Like, I've been in recovery 6 years now, and I've a toolbox of mental health tools, skills, habits, and routines that I implement in my life. And it's just, I'm really thriving in the current environment, and it's helping me to help other people, which is really, I'm delighted. So I'm in a great place, all things considered.
That's great. I can definitely attest to that personally as well. I mean, I've been a student for the last couple of years, so I've been living off canned food and just staying inside, so yeah. I'm doing pretty good too. But as you started to mention there, you're 6 years clean now and everything, and you have a very fascinating story. I came across it just like a few weeks ago or something like that. I read one of your articles. You're a public speaker and PhD candidate. So I want to get into you immediately and give you kind of room to get into to your own story and your background. So let's go back a couple of years and maybe you can just introduce yourself.
Yeah, brilliant. So I always start at the very start. Literally, my story literally started from the moment I was born, and in terms of the trauma that entered my life, which drove me behaviors thereafter. So I was basically born with a condition known as intestinal malrotation, and I was born in 1978 as well. So I had to get a big operation, and it wasn't, strangely enough, it wasn't until 1985 that the medical profession realized that infants needed anesthetics. So I literally went under the knife without an anesthetic, and for the final 2 years after that, I was crying in pain, a lot of complications, without any pain medication. So I believe that that early trauma set the tone for me being an anxious person. And I had a lot of other traumas in my life then as well, like parents that were the great parents. I really have great parents, I always say that. But there was alcoholism in the family. We moved to Canada without my mother. And there was a lot of problems, family problems, and just a lot of trauma in my early life. And I just think that really set the tone for me as being a very anxious person. So I was, when I lived in a quite a disadvantaged area as well. We moved home from Canada. We moved to a sort of poor area in Blanchardstown in Dublin city. And I suppose it was inevitable that I would try drugs at some stage, because drugs were everywhere. But I was a very anxious, restless, and uneasy child. I was academic. I was good at football. I had things going for me. But I was very restless, very agitated. And what I noticed was when I start messing around with drugs, and I was crazy about football for a long time, but when I first tasted drugs for the first time, it just started to change me mindset and just made me feel a little bit normal, a bit okay. And then I suppose I smoked hash for a few years, 14 years of age, and I got into opiates, heroin, when I was about 16, 17 years of age. Methadone when I was 16, strangely enough, and then heroin when I was 17. And that just set the tone for the rest of my life. I remember thinking, I found my first time doing heroin. It's in my book, which we'll be chatting about. I have a whole chapter designated for that night called Falling in Love. And I remember just saying to myself, this is nirvana on earth. I think it was the comparison of how uneasy and anxious I felt, where this just changed everything and made me feel whole, connected and beautiful. And I didn't get fully addicted for another 2 or 3 years. I thought I was too smart, too clever for that, because I thought myself as academic and stuff like that. But I was gone from that very first day. Within a few years, I was deep in addiction, and that's pretty much where I stayed for 15 years.
That's crazy. How did you have a lot of friends who got into it as well?
No, there's a lot of people think my story is about addiction, but it's not really. It's about anxiety, right? But then it's about self-deception. There's a line in the book actually that I wrote, and I think it really captures the book and captures my life in a nutshell. It says, I was a black belt in self-deception, and I can cross any boundary by telling myself another lie. So I was a very functional addict for many of them years, for nearly all of them years. I had a decent job. And in Ireland, we're drinkers in Ireland, and it's more socially accepted to be a heavy drinker. So people thought I was an alcoholic, and I sort of got away with it. But I was a functional heroin addict. And because I didn't believe I was a real addict, in inverted commas, not like the other addicts on the streets. And it was like my sense of identity was built up of this story that I create for myself. I'm not like them. I have a decent car. They're scumbags. I don't think that. Like, but that was the thing. I'm not a scumbag. They're scumbags. I'm not like them. They rob people. I have morals. I have values. And that just kept me trapped in addiction. But by default, to answer your question, I didn't pal around with other addicts because I didn't think I was one. So there was me and my best friend, Barry. I'll use the name I used in the book. It's a fake name. He's still deep in addiction. He's on the streets, homeless in Dublin City, probably going through torture with this coronavirus thing right now. And he's still deep in addiction. And the two of us thought we weren't real addicts. We were mad at the Jim Morrison from The Doors. And he says, you should try everything once and expand your mind. So we thought we were being cool drug users, but we were tormented by our minds and our emotions. And we were using drugs just to get away from that.
So how does it feel for you now? Because obviously you're on a completely different path in life right now. How does it feel for you to kind of look at your old friend and see how his life has gone down?
It's funny, it feels really sad, and it's not just me, my friend, even when I got clean, I had many friends in addiction, I had two brothers still in addiction as well, and it was really sad, it was very frustrating, because I couldn't do anything about it, even though I'd been an addict for years, and I thought I found a solution, I only found it for me. And addiction is a very, very multifaceted, very problematic condition, because we don't really know what it is. Like in the addiction circles, we don't know what addiction is. Like it's a form of avoidance of your feelings. It's running away from yourself. There's habits. There's all sorts of things involved in it. So everyone has a different path. So there's not one shoe fits all, one glove fits all. Is that what they say? And everyone has a different path. And what I found is that people just have to find their own way. You can plant the seed, but that's all you can do. So I just feel really sad that for the person, for me, for my friend, that what he's going through, that he can't see a way out. And I'm not frustrated anymore, because I've come full circle to realize that I need to look after me. And then if they're in a position to get help, like my younger brother James was 8 months ago, he finally got himself together. I was in a position to help him because I looked after me. So that's all you can do. Look after yourself until someone in addiction needs your help. You can plant the seed on the way, but they're not really going to listen. So it can be quite frustrating.
Yeah. So like you said, you didn't really see yourself as an addict for all those years. But how do you remember those, maybe the darkest and most destructive days now that you're a couple of years out of it?
Right, and I'll go back to the funny side of this as well. So I didn't see myself as a real addict, right? In saying that, think of how crazy this is, right? So for 12 of them years, I was a registered methadone addict. I was a registered addict by the Irish government. I was collecting methadone, drinking, going, giving urines in a clinic once a week, and to prove I was clean, which I wasn't, and giving fake urines, buying infant urine to give clean urines. I was going to a chemist every day to drink methadone, drug dealing, drug selling every day, and I still didn't think I was a real addict. the funny thing, and this is self-deception, when I did finally admit I was a real addict, because I was going so low, so deep, I started injecting at this stage, I think, as well, around that time, I finally admitted I was a real addict. But my mind was so twisted, I says, yeah, but I'm the best addict ever. I always get me drugs. Crazy thinking. And I think I went so low, I went so bad, so low in addiction, that I think I told myself that story to sort of keep myself, boost myself in some way, because I've nothing else to live for. Like, I would have been suicidal if I didn't twist my mind in some kind of a way. So when I got really, really low into the dark times, and a lot of the book delves into this, like, I ended up bringing my mom on drug deals. I ended up bringing my sister on drug deals because I couldn't drive anymore. I was sick, too sick, dragging them into dangerous situations. I got my mother's house burnt down, like, terrible, violent things going on in my life, potentially putting my family into harm, which I didn't fully feel the pain of that until I was writing the book, strangely enough, which was really bizarre. But I felt that when I was writing the book, my God. But that's where addiction brought me into a very, very, very dark spot. And then I didn't actually see the horrors of what I was going through until I eventually had to look in another direction, until I was broken, until I hit my rock bottom, and I was the world broke me, basically.
Yeah, shit. That's great. It's a lot to take in. But like you said, I mean, you were a pretty high functioning addict for all those years, but how did it look like in the days, because you wrote this about this in your article as well, like when you hit rock bottom, how did it go from being able to kind of fool yourself that you were not an addict until realizing that you had hit rock bottom?
Right, so it's funny. So I call myself a functional addict, and it wasn't until I got clean that a lot of people says I wasn't functional. There's a debate there. So I wasn't, especially for the last 5 years, there was a sharp curve, like the coronavirus, very much like the coronavirus curve on the graph at the moment. It was a sharp curve where I wasn't functioning anymore. I was losing. I sold drugs for years to feed my own habit, and I couldn't sell. I wasn't even healthy enough to sell drugs anymore, and I was losing my job. I was about to lose my job. I was falling asleep and work. I couldn't function and work, and I was about to lose my job. And that's really where it all fell apart for me. I was losing everything. And even though I still, to an extent, I start believing, right, I'm really in trouble here. I'm in a lot of trouble, but I had to carry on the facade because my job was my identity, and that was what was keeping my addiction alive. Every fiber of my being, every action I took, every thought in my mind was to keep my addiction alive, which was a sense of self and the ego that I created. I had a story. I always talk about it. I had a story that I told myself, I can't cope with anxiety and I need heroin to survive, to live in this world. That was my story. That was my self-concept. When I finally lost my job, I says, right, I can't get money anymore. I lost the job, and I says, right, I'm in trouble here. I'm going to have to look for another way. So I says, right, I'm going to try to get clean. Now, I wasn't willing to get completely clean because I didn't think I could live in the world without drugs to handle anxiety. So I says, right, I got off heroin, I got off opiates, but I'll keep taking tablets. That was the idea. That was the new thing I had planted in my head. And I don't know if you read the article. So I went to my clinic and I says, right, I want to get clean. And they told me, and this is how my book starts in the prologue. They told me that you can't get clean, or you can't go to a treatment because you need to get you need to get all the drugs out of your system, especially benzodiazepine, which is Valium and Xanax and stuff like that. So it was going to take a month for me to get them out of my system. So I says, right, well, I need to do it now, because if I don't do it now, I probably never do it. There was something in me being, in me instinct, telling me you need to do this now. So I says, right, I'm going to do cold turkey at home on my own. And the clinic warned me, don't do that, you'll have a seizure. And I says to myself, I'm a special addict again. I won't have a seizure. I'm different. And my book actually opens up the prologue. I was lying on my sitting room floor, blood stuck to me right cheek, and warm, sticky blood sticking to me right cheek. And that's how the book opens up. And what actually happened was I had a seizure 2 days into my home detox. I had a seizure and I woke up on my floor, blood everywhere. And long story short, I'd actually had a convulsive seizure where I forced my teeth, split my tongue down the middle. So I was scarring my tongue. It's every time I talk about it, horrible. But basically, I was brought to hospital. My family thought I was dead. My brother thought I was dead. My sister came to the house thinking I was dead. It was loads of mad things going on. And the pain of that night, I call that night my defining moment, but it wasn't, it was when I was in the hospital, and I'll never forget this. I was emotionally, physically, and mentally broken, like to the core. And that was, I believe, was the crack in my ego. But I remember waking up in the hospital, and I remember looking at, I was on a trolley, and I was looking at this fire extinguisher on the wall. And it was like the fire extinguisher just grabbed me into the moment. And I was just like tunnel vision looking at this fire extinguisher. And I was saying to myself, right, it's a fire extinguisher. And it's red. And I was trying to put the concepts together. It's a red fire extinguisher. I was like, I had this realization that the world wasn't making sense to me anymore. Concepts that I once knew weren't making sense. I describe it like links of a chain that I knew they went together, but I didn't know how to put them together anymore. And I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, man, that's, you're fucked. That's brain damage. Game over. And I struggled, as I mentioned, with panic attacks and anxiety all my life. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm waiting for that dread and that panic to come over me, but it didn't come over me. I remember just leaning back on the trolley and saying, I'm done, I'm give up. And I believe what I done was I surrendered for the first time in my life. I stopped fighting with my own mind. I dropped my story, and there was a chink in the ego, and I cracked my self-concept. And that's where my recovery started and where my new life began.
That's amazing. So how did the first couple of months or years of kind of getting back to life look like for you?
Crazy. The next month of my life after that moment was probably the toughest night of my life, or toughest month of my life. I went back to home to finish my home detox. I still had 4 weeks to get the benzos out of my system. So that was the crack in the ego, but another couple of seizures. And it was the most painful time of my life. I was going through cold turkey. Except for methadone, I still had methadone, which is a heroin substitute. I still had methadone in my system. So then I finally got the detox, a proper detox facility, and I came off heroin and there, another 5 weeks of torture. And it was on the 8th of October 2013 is when I had, it was my first day clean. And I don't really like saying I had an awakening. I don't like that word. I had what I call a perspective shift. And I remember walking out, the detox was on a farm in up in County Dublin, sort of a bit away from Dublin, in a farm in the countryside. Yeah, the countryside of Dublin. And I remember that morning walking out into the farm, and I remember it was just a beautiful morning. It was October, dew-soaked morning. And I remember just everything, the world just seemed beautiful. It was like the world was just glowing. Like things that were hollow, that I used to think as hollow, were just like full of life. I remember the dewdrops specifically just looked like diamonds just glistening in the sun. I was looking at the sunrise coming up from behind the trees. First sunrise I've probably seen it remembered in 15 years. And just the grass, the smell of the lush grass from the dew, it was just beautiful. And I just knew I was having this, I didn't know, I was just having this amazing experience, but I had no language for it, you know? So I pretty much, an energy came into my life that day, and I've been carrying that energy ever since. But what I came to realize when I got big into Eastern philosophy and learning, I became addicted to learning. If we get into that now in a few minutes, it could be a good way to go. But I got addicted to learning about Eastern philosophy, psychology, suffering, self. How can I help other people have what I have? And what I came to realize, I was introduced to meditation in that detox facility as well. And I remember we doing a meditation, and it was like, let the thoughts come into your mind. And I remember waiting for the thoughts and saying, oh my God, where's the thoughts? It was like, I know that in essence, is where's the thoughts is a thought, but it was like my mind was really quiet. And what I came to believe was that I was forced into submission by this pain in my life, and it forced my mind to shut the hell up, stop fighting, stop resisting, shut the hell up. And by having that space of a quiet mind, it was like sensory perceptions were lifted to another level and an energy came into my life. Now, since then, I got very into learning, and I got back into the normal world after detox and after treatment, and I went back to college, and I was addicted to learning, back into the social world, and my mind has gotten busier again, so I'm not going around in that lovely mold where twinkle, dewdrops look like diamonds. That was a short period that I had, but I still have kept this very, very much so lovely sense of energy, a lovely sense of feeling, and a sense of being on bonus time, which is the title of my book. I feel like I was given a second chance at life, and I don't let external events bother me. And I just have a way of reframing things and rethinking about the world in a different way. And a core thing that was a huge part of my recovery was that I like if you're being addicted for years and years and years, from a neuroscience perspective, you've basically feeding your brain with dopamine, 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 dopamine. So when people get clean, you haven't got that dopamine hit anymore. But I got addicted to learning very quick. I suppose in the real world now we just call it drive. But I was just getting me hits from learning and Eastern philosophy, absolutely blown away by this new way of life. And I just hooked me dopamine hooks, claws into that and ran with that. And I've been learning ever since. And that compounding effect of loving to learn has just had a massive impact in my life. And went back to college doing a PhD. I'm a lecturer in neuroscience in Trinity College in Dublin here as well. And I just love this lifestyle, you know.
That's beautiful. How did it feel for you going back to kind of the real world after all that and like getting back to school and everything? And I don't know what your relationship was like with your friends, if you still had friends left from that time. Yeah. I'm not sure how it worked. And also with family, like how did you mend those relationships if they were broken? And how did it feel to kind of be back amongst people who were not addicts?
Right. There's a three-word answer to that. Not very well. I didn't do a good job. It was very funny. So a huge thing that came out of my realization when I was writing the book was that I never learned the art of perspective taking. I never took other people's perspective. I had anxiety. I needed to get rid of my anxiety. I needed drugs. Me. I didn't think about other people unless it was a drug dealer and could he give me drugs. That was my repertoire of perspective taking. And I certainly couldn't feel empathy for other people. I didn't even think about their feelings, never mind feeling their feelings. So when I got clean, I knew this was very important, but I had no realization of it. So when I got clean, I sort of thought everybody knew I was on this bright, fluffy cloud and I felt amazing without them knowing what I experienced. And I tormented my family for years, not in a physical way, like sort of an emotionally tortured them by killing myself kind of way. And they seen me killing myself for years and years and years. So then I go nearly die with the seizure and I go into detox and treatment for a couple of months and I come out and I try to tell them how to live their lives. Which didn't go down very well, as you can imagine. But yeah. I didn't have the language. Like I did have that shift and I knew something profound happened to me, but I didn't have the language to talk about it. So one of the things that's in the book, it's really funny. Like I used to go and because when we were in detox, we used to pick our own strawberries. And I remember just eating these strawberries and it just felt amazing eating these strawberries. The sensations of it in my mouth was like eating for the first time. So when I got out, I was literally telling people, I got this bag and it's me Jack Bauer. Do you ever see the series Jack Bauer 24?
Yeah, 24.
Yeah. So I love Jack Bauer and I had this sort of satchel that I called me Jack Bauer bag before I got clean. And I used to put the strawberries into me Jack Bauer bag and I'd go around to my family and my friends and say, taste that strawberry. And try to forget about your worries and really focus on the strawberries. And they all thought I was bloody mad. and I was from their perspective and my perspective because I hadn't got the language. So that didn't last too long. Yeah. And I was in that very spiritually fluffy sort of vibe for a while, not living in the real world. But I started to cop on pretty quick. Not pretty quick, maybe a year or two. It took time. But I went back to college quick and I made new relationships with new people that didn't know the old me. And it was easier to make them relationships because it was new, the new me. And they seen me as energetic and sort of having a laugh, having fun, being very playful. But it took a few years to build a relationship, especially with my sister and my mom and with my existing friends. Like I still had friends, good friends that weren't in addiction. My best friend, Gar, I've built great relationships with him since and my family. Like the relationships I have with my family now are just awesome. Like with my brothers, my sister, with my mom, like the addiction sort of ran in my family. So from my experiences, then people sort of looked at themselves and it was more drinking issues. They don't drink anymore. And it's a lot more meditation, a lot more of a spiritual life we all have now. So we've already had incredible relationships. But I would say last summer while writing the book, where I wouldn't say I interviewed my family, but I chatted to them about the problems I caused in their lives. And it was like a cleansing, a therapeutic cleansing for them and me, where I could really apologize and say, I'm sorry. But my God, did I get me perspective taking skills? I developed perspective taking skills and I felt their pain. Like I would be very productive. I would get a lot done because I focus on what's important and I know what I value and I know what my goals are and I know what my purpose is. So I get a lot done. I know what my first domino is and I'm really good around that. So, but, and I always get stuff done every day. That's one of my main mantras, is every day, consistency every day. But there was a couple of days throughout the summer where I had a book deadline that was looming and I just couldn't work because I was emotionally drained, because I felt about, in the space of a few days, I felt all the pain that I caused the people most closest to me. And that was really, really tough. But the flip side of that was we've brilliant relationships after that, and it's gone really well since then.
That's great to hear. I think one of the coolest things about living in 2020, right, and you know, with the internet and everything, is that even if you lived kind of the life you did for many years, and maybe there, it's hard to find other people in your community to connect with that has similar inspiring stories and that kind of can set a path for you to follow. So I can imagine, as you said, you looked into a lot of Eastern philosophy, and what were some of the other people who kind of inspired you to get back and to find this new life?
Right. I always seem to be saying the same two books and when I talk to anybody, but they had such a huge impact on my life. I'll give another book just after that, just as something different, because I talk about these in my own book as well. But Awareness by Anthony DeMello was just a game changer for me. And what his story is all about waking up. Like, most people live their lives asleep. They never wake up. If I died in addiction, I would have lived my whole life asleep. I never woke up. I was never fully aware. And when he's talking about asleep, he's talking about stressed out of their heads, being tormented by their minds, worry and anxiety, all of these kinds of things. And you don't wake up to the beauty of life. And that was a game changing book for me. And he just tells people, wake the hell up. Like, that was his message. That was his message. It was a great message. Eckhart Tolle's The Power Now was a huge book for me. It was like, it became my Bible in recovery. And there's three lessons from his book which were groundbreaking for me. And one of them is observe self. So be the observer or the witness of your mind instead of being the thinker. And to be, for me now, to be able to take a step back from my emotions. I don't struggle with anxiety anymore. I still get anxious when I'm doing public speaking or I'm doing a big event, but I observe the anxiety passing through me instead of being the anxiety. I observe dark thoughts instead of being the thoughts. So being the observer was a great lesson I learned from Eckhart Tolle. And just being, stop doing and just being, just like, just be a human being. Like, it's like, look at the stars and just be. It's a hard concept to grasp, but I think he explains it great in the concept. He says, like, a frog isn't doesn't have self-esteem issues. A racehorse isn't jealous because another racehorse won the race. They're like human qualities, thinking qualities. So just be like an animal, just be. And that was a great lesson I learned from him. And another one, and it was the article you read where you came across me, was Tim Ferriss has been a huge inspiration in my life as well. And his book, Tribe of Mentors, where he reached out to the most successful, he reached out to highly successful people to learn the tools and tactics in their lives, had such a big impact on my life that when I was struggling with my own, getting my message across to school kids, I thought to myself, wow, imagine I had reached out to people, very successful people in Ireland, and I could share their tools because the kids would listen to me then, because they weren't really listening to my message, especially in a former addict. And that, by him writing his book, gave me the idea to write my book, and or not to write my book, to reach out to successful people in Ireland, which is his second book, and gone it right. And that just had a tremendous impact on my life. It ended up that the reason to reach out to these people was to learn the tactics about their lives. But it was a lot of CEOs, a lot of sports people, celebrities and stuff, but especially the CEOs brought me in to do talks into their companies. And I've just built tremendous connections, mentorships, amazing relationships with these people. And only this week, which is strange if you think about it, I'm a former heroin addict. I have some of the leading CEOs in Ireland giving me a call saying, can I speak to their teams about tools and tactics to cope with the coronavirus, which is a crazy turnaround, you know?
Yeah, that's incredible. Congrats.
Yeah,
that's, cheers. You've come full circle. Really.
I certainly have. It's usually I say it was nothing and I don't take credit for it. But the thing is, I do genuinely feel like I jumped into a roller coaster and I've been brought along for the ride. So I'm very, very grateful that my addictive personality kicked into the learning perspective. It was like something happened to me rather than me being courageous and brave and doing it. So I'm just very grateful for the experience as well, you know?
Yeah. Sometimes I just think like addiction is kind of a, what do they say? Like zero sum game. Like you need some, it's a constant. Like you always need something to be addicted to if you stop one thing. But obviously being addicted to learning is obviously, a bit better. Yeah.
It's funny. And I think balance is key. It's a value of mine, but it is crucial at some stage, maybe I'll get there, and to keep an eye on that, but it's okay to be all or nothing in some ways. Once you're aware, having the awareness of it's crucial.
Absolutely. I want to get into that question in the article that Tim Ferriss asked, and that made a big impact in your life as well. He said, what would this look like if it were easy? And I came across it. I listened to his podcast as well, and I came across it, I don't know, a while ago. And it's something I have to keep like reminding myself of, because like many people, I believe still to some degree, but I try to kind of think less about it. But that if you want to achieve something, that you have to, you know, it has to be tough to get there. Like there's no easy way, and I have to suffer in order to gain something. But what did your life look like when you kind of discovered that question or heard it, and how did it impact your life?
Yeah, it's crazy. And before, I think it's key as well. I don't think you can get away from that, because I think a lot of the biggest gains come through suffering. I think it's Ray Dalio says that pain plus reflection equals progress. So there's a lot of these big thinkers think on them lines. And I definitely do. Like, I think being anti-fragile, like it's thriving through adversity is key. But that question is such a good question, and I do have to keep reminding myself about it as well. And I think we can get caught up in too many tools, too many tactics, and then you don't use any when it comes down to it. So I think it's key to have a couple of key phrases in your life, and that's a great one, because it flips the thing on its head and says, right, instead of going through the adversity and looking for the hard way, what's the easy way of doing things? The path of least resistance. And I suppose how that had a big impact on my life is if I need a question now, I have a mantra. It's probably the biggest mantra that leads my life. And it makes my life, I don't know how it hones in on that exact question, but it makes my life very, very, very easy and struggle free to an extent as well. And it's like this: be true to your wonderfully weird self. You'll attract what you need and you'll repel what you don't. And why that makes my life very easy is because, let's say the example of me reaching out to people. I reached out to lots and lots of people, lots of top CEOs, top people in the country, right? Now, some of them didn't get back to me. Most of them got back to me, which was brilliant, but a lot of them didn't get back to me. But from my perspective, I was true to myself. When I wrote that email to many of these people, I said I'm a ridiculously enthusiastic learner. I let them know what they were dealing with. I told them about my struggles. I put everything on a page. So they knew what they were dealing with. So the people that didn't get back to me, they shouldn't get back to me, because they'd be wasting their time and they'd be wasting my time, because I was true to myself. So it's a way, what would this look like if it were easy? If you're being completely true to yourself, and you get rejection, accept that rejection, because it's not really rejection, because you can't vibe with everyone in this world. If you think you're going to get on with everyone and you want everyone to like it, you're in a really bad place, because everyone will not like it. But the differences are what make us human. Our differences are what define us to a certain extent as well. So what would this look like if it were easy? From that perspective, just believe that not everyone will like it. You're going to have ups and downs. And accept, roll with the punches as it comes in. Or it's about perception really as well. How you actually perceive these things is interesting as well, you know? I don't know if I've answered that question. I've answered it in a roundabout way, very political way.
Yeah, absolutely. So what kind of areas in life do you think you can ask yourself or implement the ideas behind that question?
I think you can implement this question. That's the beauty of this question, in any aspect of your life. So I only tweeted Tim Ferriss the other day, actually. He's a hard man to get to. I've never gotten... he sent me a book for a competition I won. Of Tribe of Mentors, which is pretty cool. But I'd love to have a chat with him someday. I think I actually told him I'll be on his podcast someday in a year or two. Just to be cheeky. It's like, be true to yourself. You'll attract what you need, repel what you don't. But I tweeted him the other day and I says, Tim, says, I'd love to hear what your followers would have to say about the coronavirus. What would this look like if it were easy? Like, forget about the vaccines, they're the normal things, but what would this look like if it were easy? And the idea of this question really is just journaling on this question and throwing it out onto a page, doing a brain dump of what this would look like if it were easy. Off the top of my head, with the coronavirus thing, we'd move to another planet. Like, I'm talking about off the chart questions. We'd move to another planet. We'd have laser guns to kill the virus. We found a dye to dye the virus so we could see it on tables, like the way them ads show germs and stuff like that. Like, but if you go at lots of different things in a certain way, you might get one little nugget, one little idea that will jump out off the page. So in any aspect of life, what will this look like if it were easy? You can use it anywhere. So for myself, going forward, let's say after COVID is gone, like my speaking career, there won't be money for speaking career. My book launch is this Friday, and the book is literally going to be swamped over. Like, it was going to be a big deal in Ireland. Hope with a bit of luck, it was looking good. I had lots of talk shows, radio shows. One or two are still going ahead, but people aren't interested in someone's in recovery. So what would that look like if it were easy? Well, it would look like that I could tie it in some way with the coronavirus, and that is what I'm going to try to do. So I'm going to say, right, it's a story of resilience. If you want to read this book and find out how to be resilient, and I'm going to really tie it more into the tools and tactics that I've used to thrive in recovery and thrive during the coronavirus as it's gone on so far. So that's what that will look like if it were easy. I will just try to sell that in a certain way. But you could do this with anything. Like, let's say, off the top of my head, if you were at home, doing a home in isolation, what would that look like if it were easy? You would have a gym. So where can you go with that kind of thinking, right? You could create your own gym. You could work from home. Let's say you can't work from home. Let's say your business goes to pot. Well, all of a sudden, what would it look like if you're easy? Give you another opportunity, another way of thinking about it. Well, I could think about that from another perspective. I could start a hobby, the passion that I always wanted to start. So it just gets you to think about things. It doesn't always give you the answer, but it gets you to think about things from a different perspective, and hopefully that can give you an answer.
Absolutely. And I think also just asking yourself the question and not, you know, putting everything on the table and even the most outrageous ideas you might have also gives you some perspective and might even add a bit of like humor to it, and it makes you realize that maybe it's not as important as I think it is. So that's just another thing it serves. So you kind of talked about this a little bit, about not getting too stuck in the tools, routines, and habits of other people. And it's probably my one critique of Tim Ferriss. I mean, he does a great job, and like, that's his thing. But I think if you listen to him, like to his podcast, or only read his books too much, you kind of think like, all right, well, I definitely need to do everything that all these people are doing. But it's more about, obviously his mission is for everyone to kind of find their own stuff. But how did... What tools or habits or whatever did you pick up over the years, and how did examining those different things from successful people kind of inspire or help you?
There's a couple of things, so I still have to go through all the research for the book. The one thing of the successful people and of the interviews I've done so far, and of the certain questions I ask, a couple of things always jump out at me, and the threads that I've come in. It says, when you feel too stressed, is to just take a step back from the situation and break it into bite-sized chunks. And I've heard so many of them say that it's really, really stuck with me. There was another brilliant woman in Ireland. She's the CEO of Enterprise Ireland, one of the biggest enterprise companies over here. And she was saying, for every decision that you're about to make, imagine that it's going to be on the front page of the Sunday World. Would you still do it? And the Sunday World is a big newspaper over here. So would you still do it if everyone knew about it? Like saying, I don't know how many people wash their hands. I think the amount of people is like 80% for women or 50% for men. It's some mad stat like that. But every bloke, if they knew it, would be plastered on the Sunday World, that they would wash their hands. So it's like, do the right thing because it's the right thing, not because nobody knows about it, you know? So they're two little nuggets I got off them. But from my own tactics that I've picked up, and most of my tactics have really come from the books I've read, and most of these people are dead. Marcus Aurelius would be a huge mentor of mine. Anthony DeMello would be a huge mentor of mine. But self-observation is probably the most important tool in my locker. And I got it from Eckhart Tolle, but then Anthony DeMello talks about it as well. And it's really just a form of mindfulness. And it's really just observing yourself, observing your behaviors, your emotions, your feelings. And the reason why I think it's so important, because I think you can have all of the best tools, tactics in the world. I could have all of Tim Ferriss's tools and tactics memorized and do them off the drop of a hat. But if I'm not self-aware, I won't know when to use them. I won't be aware of my values or of my goals. You've got to be self-aware first. And I think that's really where it's important to be, to self-observe how you feel, how other people, how you are around other people. That's where emotional intelligence comes in and all of these different aspects. So I think to be self-aware through self-observation is the most important tool that I've picked up. On a more tangible level, and the tool that I've used, and it goes down really, really well in the corporate world and with many people, they always bring it back to this tool that I use, and it's the one they really remember. And it's a question that the Great Britain rowing team asked themselves in the 2000 Olympics, the build-up to the 2000 Olympics, and they basically asked themselves, does it make the boat go faster? They were talking with their actual rowing boat. So I developed a metaphorical boat myself based on my values, my purpose, and my goals. So my purpose in life is to show people that change is possible based on actionable steps through my own lived experience. That's my purpose in life. And I do that especially with young people in of today. And it's, my God, that's needed more than ever. My goals were my PhD, were my book, and it was my speaking career. But in the last 2 weeks, my goals is the self mental health of those around me and my loved ones and my self-care. They're my two number one goals right now. So my bow has changed in the last 2 weeks. My values, boldness is a big value of mine. Ambition, industry, they're huge values of mine. But in the last 2 weeks, they've changed a little bit. The rudder of that boat has changed direction. Compassion, connection, they're my core values right now. They were already core values, but they're the most important values. I've elevated them values right now. Patience, another core value. So what I will say to myself when I'm going to make a decision, will it make my boat go faster? So in other words, will it make my self-care go faster? Will it make the self-care of other, the mental health of those around me go faster? And I base my decisions on that. With my values, I'll scan my values and I say, am I being patient? Am I focusing on connection and community? Because they're needed right now. So that has probably been the biggest tool in my life. And even in the coronavirus, I'm basing my decisions around that tool. I'm asking myself, will it make the boat go faster? And if there's anyone listening to this podcast, it's very, very simple. And they can just say, right, what's my metaphorical boat? Especially now, if they're listening to it in a couple of weeks after the coronavirus thing calms down, hopefully, they could say, what's their goal? Their own mental health. What's their value? Community and family. And what's their purpose? They can work on that themselves. Maybe it's a family unit as well. So for every decision they make, they'll say, will it make their own metaphorical boat go faster? And it's just a really great way of making decisions on things you've reflected deeply upon.
That's great. Sounds like you've given this a lot of thought. And I think that's absolutely right. Yeah. I think one of the things when I read or listen to Tim Ferriss or like people like him, you know, these kind of gurus, whatever, that you take all their tricks and tips and to get some kind of inspiration to pull through or to push yourself through the hard work. But I think sometimes, I don't know if it's because of lack of passion for whatever project it is or something, but I think a lot of people get that kind of hit of inspiration and then it dies out and then they kind of go back or revert into their old ways. How do you think we can avoid that?
Wow, this is the monster. This is the monster. And I always finish my talks. This is the number one for me. If I had three words for anyone, advice for anyone, the three words would be the same word. Consistency, consistency, consistency. And that's the key. And I have a metaphor for this. I finish a lot of my talks on this as well. And so imagine you're climbing Mount Everest. Most people get the inspiration, they get the hit, it's the new year, they listen to a podcast, they feel inspired and they go building that habit. Yeah, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. So they walk and they're climbing Mount Everest. They get the base camp and they look up and they say, oh, it's too hard, and they give up. But what you have to keep doing to reach the goals and get the benefits of these tools, and which compound over time, and it's like a snowball gaining momentum if you keep on climbing up that hill. But all you have to do is keep on putting one step after another. There's a great line by Jerry Seinfeld, and it's like, don't break the chain. So I have a morning routine, and it's my number one. Every morning I get up and I do my morning routine. It's around meditation, gratitude, inner child work, affirmations, and Mavic gratitude and visualization. So they're the five things. I have an acronym for it, and I do that every single day. Coronavirus hits, I do that every single day. World War III hits, I'm still gonna do that every single day. From Jerry Seinfeld, I don't break the chain. So even if I only have a minute to do it, I don't break the chain. So that's the consistency. That's a way of keeping that consistency going. But people always break down because of the habits. They don't keep them habits going. And I think I wrote an article on this a while ago, and it's really four, if I can remember, the four things for building habits. Like it's all about, I won't go into the neuroscience of habit formation, but one of the biggest ways to keep habits going is to change your environment. So a lot of people think about motivation, you have to stay motivated, but people think motivation is in their head, and if they fail, they think that they're not motivated, that it's their fault. But what I would say, let's say you want to build a habit and you want to read a book, that's your new habit, you want to read a book every night. Well, one of the reasons why most people fail on their habits is because they simply forget. The next time I need to work on a certain problem, I might forget that question from Tim Ferriss. What would this look like if it were easy? So you've got to change your environment to make you remember about the habit. So what I would do is I'd leave that book on the bed. So I remember when I'm going to bed, oh, I have to read the book, change the environment. Another great way of doing this, this is probably the best way, it's from a great book. What a great book this is, Atomic Habits by James Clear. Yeah. Best book I read last year, amazing. But the one piece I took from that, it's actually associative learning from psychology, but he calls it habit stacking. So he stacks one habit on top of another. So what I've been telling people around coronavirus times was, because I think it's really important to keep it simple, instead of starting this mindfulness practice, which is great, but if you've never practiced mindfulness before, this isn't the time to be doing it because you're so anxious and you're so nervous. So I'm like, stack it on top of an existing habit. So say brushing your teeth. So practice mindfulness for 1 minute after you brush your teeth, or mindfully brush your teeth. Or we're all washing our hands 20 times a day at the minute, so mindfully wash your hands. So stack that habit onto an existing habit, and then you will stick with it. And when you go and do the habit that already exists, you'll remember through association of your new habit. And that's a really, really powerful way to introduce new habits in your life. But the great thing about a habit is, and there's no set day, there's no 21 days or 60 days, it's about repetition, how many times you do it. But once you ingrain a habit into your system, it's harder not to do it than it is to actually stop doing it. That's why I just get up and I do my morning routine.
Yeah, it's like Pavlov's dogs. Like if you want to write a journal every day, you know, you do it when you're having a cup of coffee, because every time you smell a cup of coffee, you're going to want to write that journal.
Great example.
Every time I hear anything about Seinfeld regarding this, I just remember hearing him saying in some interview that every morning when he wakes up, he like opens his eyes, he's like, ready, set, and then he gets out of bed, go.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
That's another little tip as well. It's just that Nike thing, just do it. Or there's a great one from Mel Robbins. It's actually 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. And if you keep on going on the go, I remember I'd done that, and I'd done it for months. So once I said to myself, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go, and I just have to go. Because I was so successful at it for a while, I couldn't fail because I'd built up this habit. So I had to do it. It's these little tips just work, like, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I have one more like big question for you before we kind of round this up. But obviously most people don't have to go through what you were through to kind of realize that they need to make a change in their life. But I think most of us sometimes find ourselves stuck in a rut, or we're unhappy, but we're not sure why or whatever. How do you recognize that you're unhappy or that you're in a rut, do you think? Or that you just need a change?
Yeah, and this is a tough one. This is a tough one because the change, it's like the chicken and the egg. The change you need to make makes you aware of that. Like if you're more present, you're going to be more aware of these things. Like if I need to make a change because I meditate and because I think reflectively, I'm more primed to catch that problem. Well, what I would say to other people, if they're listening to this and they're wondering, how can I actually go about that? I think journaling, as you mentioned, is a great way. Reflective thinking is a great way. But it's try to just sit with yourself and honestly ask yourself, are you happy? It's about getting really, really honest with yourself. Are you happy on a daily basis? Are you doing something that you like? Do you wake up in the morning with excitement in your belly. Like, we should all have an excitement. We should all be doing something that fills us with joy, that lights us up. And I know not everyone in the world can be doing that. Some jobs just aren't going to light you up. That's just the way it is. But you don't have to be that person. You can follow your passion. And there's other aspects of that as well. You might have family and you might just have to do things to pay the bills. And that's fair enough as well. But I think, honestly ask yourself through journaling, through reflective thinking. It doesn't have to be meditation. It could be just sitting with yourself, trying to listen to your instinct, trying to listen to your gut, and just try to feel it. Just try to be quiet with yourself and try to feel it. Are you happy? Let it be a process. There's no quick fix on this. This is sort of a process. And I think the hunger itself, if you're asking yourself them questions, and if you're probably listening to the podcast like this and listening to talks like this, you are looking for them questions already. So I think you're 10 steps ahead of many other people. You're looking for them questions already. So what I would say is just try to sit with that. Get honest with yourself. Journaling is a great thing. Do you know what's another great thing? Seek feedback off other people. It's like the Johari window. It's like, I can't remember the ins and outs of it, but it's like we can't see our own issues, but other people can see the things that are going on in our lives. So ask other people, ask that question, do you think I'm happy? And try to get someone that you can believe or you can trust. Like I often ask people, I have a question I ask people I really trust. I call them the idiot checkers to make sure I'm not being an idiot. But I say to them, how do you see me, what I'm doing right now, how do you see me limiting myself in my life? So it gives them a way that you're not saying, what am I doing, stupid? So how do you see me limiting myself? And you might be able to just get a little bit honest with you. So ask other people, do you think I'm happy? Do you see myself limiting myself? Have you got that fire in your belly? And maybe just sit with that and process it. Let it sit there for a while, because the answers might jump up straight away.
That's great advice. Thank you so much. Really, it's, it's amazing. All right, we're going to round off soon, but bonus time, your book. We've talked a little bit about it, but can you just a little bit more, like what's it about? When is it coming out? It will be out when this episode airs, but
yeah. Brill. So the book is basically, it's my memoir, and it starts off from the moment I was born. It starts off the prologue where I'm lying on a puddle of blood. And it says, I'm now living on, but it ends in that I first tasted bonus time when I had that experience when I went to hospital. But then it gets into what bonus time is. And bonus time, living on bonus time, is basically not worrying about what others think, not getting caught up and comparing myself to other people, being allowed to live, act boldly, dare greatly, and take chances, dream big in life, and just go for things, not be worrying about the silly little things that used to really bother me. That's what living on bonus time is. And for me, I was given a second chance at life, and I just feel I'm just going to take this. I'm going to devour the second opportunity. So it's really a memoir that starts off with me as a baby, because I had to jump a few hurdles along the way to get into bonus time, which started from the moment I was born. And then, but it really goes into the depths of my drug addiction, a lot of stuff about bodily orifices and stuff like that. Not too much about that, but it really goes into the dark and murky world of addiction, the self-deception that I was in, the harm I caused my parents. Like, I left nothing out. I really got into it. And I think of the couple of people that have read it as well, like, there's a fun element to it as well. Like, I kept it not tongue in cheek, but I put the silly bits in as well. It's a lot of me being sort of a bit scruffy and not washing for a while and stuff like that. But it's a fun thing as well. But then the end of the book, it's not the last half of the book, it's probably the last third of the book, is me finding bonus time and finding that joy in my life and just going out there, living, taking chances, and using my tools. Like one of the tools I used was the metaphorical bow. Cut 2 years off my PhD, like, of the amount of work that I had to do. I have an easy PhD, focused PhD, because of these tools. And it's really just about the trials and tribulations, the difficulties I faced while I was in recovery, how I started my speaking career, how I was nervous, but how using them tools, especially self-observation, that I'm able to catch anger, negative emotions in full flight without getting bothered by it. Like, the book itself is out this Friday, and the whole thing has been ruined to an extent, but that's the language I don't use myself. That's language that other people are putting on it. I would say, here, it's just what it is, and we'll see how it goes. And that's what the book is about, really, is about, just second chances.
Yeah, well, I'm so excited to read it, especially after talking to you now for almost an hour. Where can people find it, and where can people find out more about you?
So I suppose the best place to go would be my website. So it's www.brianpennie.com. It's P-E-N-N-I-E. So I'm on LinkedIn, Instagram, Quora, Twitter, all of the platforms. But if they went to my website, they'll see me blogs in there. You can buy the book from there as well, internationally and at home. And you can hook up to all the platforms in there as well. But that would be the place to go. I have a lot of videos in there of past talks, tools that I've used in my own life, and my blog is there as well. So.
That's amazing. Yeah, and I checked out your website. You can find all your information on it. So that's probably where I'd tell people to go as well. And I'll leave everything in the description. So
brilliant. A good thing that grabs people's attention is that if you go to the About section on my website, you see the before after pics, which are pretty shocking, of what I used to look like to what I look like now. I think a picture paints 1,000 words, they say.
it's not the same person.
No, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's insane. Well, Brian, seriously, I cannot thank you enough. I feel like I gained like 30 IQ points throughout this hour, and I know people pay you to get this kind of information and these stories from you, so I'm very grateful that you wanted to chat with me here today.
This was a buzz. Actually, I need to have goosebumps here, Adam. No, I just love this, man. It was just brilliant. Really enjoyed it. And great questions, man. You just made a sale. Brilliant. Loved it. Loved this podcast.
It's all you. Well, anyway, thank you so much and good luck with everything with the book. Yeah, and despite it being Corona pandemic times, people should buy it and read it because now everyone has time.
is it as well.
yeah. All right, Brian. Thank you so much.
See you later, Adam. Love. It's a beautiful day.